start dealing with fruit juice, so then you start dealing with the grape juice as well. So then you have to be worried about, well, if it's grape juice, so A, it's not going to be likely, not likely to be kosher grape juice. And B, is it going to compromise the status of the equipment? Is the equipment that's used for non-kosher grape juice going to be kosher? That being said, there's an awful lot of kosher grape juice being imported into China for kosher food production. You'll see that the OU has a bunch of brands, and the Half Moon K, which was really bought out by the OU, and that's really where a lot of this started, where they're importing grape juice from Israel to China to be used for these productions. Now, where we ran into another problem is that sometimes the grape juice that are importing from Israel, if it's from last year's stock, could be a question of Shemitah. So, you know, you can have, it can come with a hechsher that you may not necessarily approve of, because we have all these questions as to if it's the Shemitah fruit, as to whether or not we would use it, even though there may be some who would approve it, and if it's coming from Israel. So, all kinds of different details that something could seem simple, it's not always so simple. Just talking more about, let's say, food production. No, thank you. A lot of the food ingredients that we make or that we oversee or that we certify are, lots of times they make food ingredients by what's called fermentation. We know the simple fermentations that we have all the time are wine. It's obviously fermented grape juice. And yeast, which is fermentation of yeast as opposed to bacteria. But what scientists have been able to control and learn over the years is that they can produce all kinds of things like what we call amino acids. Right? Do we know that they have our whole list that they taught us in school of amino acids that make up protein? So a lot of these amino acids can be singled out and refined by growing bacteria on something like sugar water or some glucose or sorbitol and things like that. And if you use this specific type of bacteria, you can end up with a different type of amino acids. So we know some of the old ones that we've had for years and years, like glutamic acid, which is the main ingredient in MSG. So every Chinaman has to have MSG for breakfast. So MSG is an old one, and not everybody tolerates MSG, as you all know. But so glutamic acid is something that is for years and years been going on. And in the olden days, what they would do is they would ferment it primarily on something like a glucose, but oftentimes to give it a little protein kick. So they'll add something like a meat extract or fish extract or something like that into the soup so that it gets so that it keeps those bacteria happy so that you can get the proper result. So that's something that we look into, and different questions in halacha as to whether or not in, let's say, an earlier stage of fermentation, if there was a little bit of iser or a non-kosher content in there, would that affect the final kosher status? If at the later stages it's all kosher or not, that's something that we have to look into, and something that different rabbanim have different opinions on how to deal with that.
Are bacteria kosher?
Well, bacteria are microscopic, so they don't really have a halachic status, as anything that is microscopic doesn't really have a halachic status. So you really have to judge with the thing that's coming in front of you, which makes it more, make us more to focus on what your ingredients are more so than the actual bacteria. But that being said, if you're looking at this glob of, they have different terms of it, if you're looking at this glob of fermented mass that they're going to use to produce the different ingredients or the different products, so you'd have to judge as to what its halachic status is. And you can only judge that by looking at what it took to make it. So there are different rules in halacha that we find, like the simple case that we have find in halacha that goes back generations is the making of cheese. Right? Cheese, you take, in the olden days, the Gemara calls it, and you see still in Shulchan Aruch, it refers to taking the keva. Keva literally is the stomach. So they would take the stomach of a young calf and they would toss that into the pot of milk, and the natural enzymes that are in there would act to ferment or cause a reaction in the milk. So then you have questions as to, well, keva from the meat of the animal is flesh, and you're dealing with milk, so how does that work in halacha? Then other times we find in halacha that it doesn't necessarily mean the actual stomach, but rather they would scrape out the milk or residue that the calf would have in its stomach, and that residue would be high in enzymes that the animal had already given into that residue in its digestion, and you toss that into a milk, so then what would be the status of the milk that you get afterwards? So we have all kinds of halachic questions that stem back from before, and really it's a matter of application to the modern day situations where you have what is sometimes classified as where you have Isser and Heter together to cause something, to create a reaction, which in halacha is referred to sometimes as zevezegorim. You have a quality of this and a quality of that, and they're creating a third thing. So what is the status of the third thing? And we know always there's a halacha of bitul barov, that you can nullify. Now, you're not allowed to create a situation where you are taking Isser and adding it to Heter and saying, oh, it's kosher because it's only 1/40th. I mean, 1/65th, right? It has to be less than 1/60th. You're not allowed to create such a situation. But let's say that's how they're always doing it, and the Goy is doing it for his needs in his lab, and he's not doing it for Bittel, but rather he's doing it just to make this thing. And it's a situation where it's classified as, well, you have this and that, and together they're making this, but, and there's a big but, you don't really need the non-kosher part. It's just the non-kosher part accelerates the process. So what is the halachic status of that product? So those are things that we have to deal with, that it's, you know, you look at it, it may be good, it may be no good, and you have to present it to your rabbi. That's why we have Rabbi Heinemann here, who's our chief rabbi, and he looks at the information that we can present before him to judge as to whether or not there's a halachic issue and whether or not it'll be good or won't be good. So that's the type of things that they're using in making. I gave an example of amino acids. Simple amino acids, like I said, is, let's say, glutamic acid and MSG, but there's all kinds of food additives that are made through this type of processing. Some are simpler than others as far as what they usually add, but, you know, the most common are citric acid, lactic acid, ascorbic acid, that those are commonly added as preservatives, or they're added to just to give a sour taste of things. Then you have, like I said, the amino acids, like glutamic, but there's also things like L-proline and a whole list of, like, L-aspartic. L-aspartic acid, we don't really think about L-aspartic acid too much, but they use L-aspartic acid to make something that may be in your Diet Coke, which is called aspartame. Aspartame is made from L-aspartic acid. So all these things, there's a run-on effect for everything when you're looking at the greater scheme of things, and sometimes it's more of a question, sometimes it's less of a question, and that's really what we send people into different factories just to take a look at all the time. And of course, when you're looking at a factory, you're looking at what's done in the factory and what you're doing for your product, but you're also looking at what else may be done on the same equipment. And just like when you cook at home, you know, if your pot was used for milchik, you can't use it for fleischik, or if that by accident, and I'm sure this never happens in your house, it only happens in my house, accidentally you take the wrong thing, and you used it for that and it became treif. So what will be the situation in these factory settings? So you have to always judge with that. When you have, let's say, a manufacturer that's manufacturing something that's UHT, ultra-high temperature that they use for preservatives, milk you get now, you get these things so you can have a long-life milk and can sit on the shelf for 300 years and it won't taste any different than it did the day after they made it. So that stuff, what they do is, how do they keep to preserve it? They don't necessarily have to add preservatives, but because they treat it with an ultra-high temperature, and the way they do that is they bring the temperature way up very quickly and then cool it off very quickly. So in so doing, apparently it doesn't change the taste all that much, even though nobody will ever say it tastes exactly the same as fresh milk. But, you know, even that doing that, will act as kill all the bacteria, and you'll be able to if they pack it right away. So then it's going to stay fresh for a very long time. Now, if they run the same equipment to run milk and then they run some other product on it, so then you would have a question as to what is the status of the equipment. Is this equipment all milchic? Now, to make that milk get hot, so you had to have a boiler water. The boiler water has to be heating up the equipment, heating up the milk itself. Now, to heat up the milk itself, what they do is you have, let's say, two cylinders, if you can picture it. You'll have an outer cylinder, outer pipe, and an inner pipe. The outer pipe will be running, let's say, hot water, and the inner pipe will be running cold water. Okay? So, and it will be running the product. So now you're going to have this product that, as it's running through this pipe, at whatever rate it's running, it's getting very hot because it's going through an outer pipe of very hot water. And then a moment later, it's going to be going through ice water to cool it down very quickly. Now, the ice water may get warm because it's come to have the incoming product that's getting very hot. So you have to judge what is the status of the hot water on the outside. That it did it become milchik? Did it become dairy in this situation? Because if the example would be, you know what a double boiler is? Your wife ever cooked, make something in a double boiler. So
what is that exactly?
A double boiler? Okay. So in a simple case, a double boiler would be that if your wife wants to make a, let's say, a lemon, like a lemon filling. So what you do, like a lemon meringue or something like that, so what you do is you heat it up, not directly over the stove, because if you heat it over fire, then it would burn it. So what you do is you put it in, you have this thing that inserts into boiling water, and you heat it up by getting it heated in boiling water, because then it doesn't heat it up as sharply, whatever. It won't, they're less likely to burn it, it's more even. So that's what a double boiler does. So similarly, that's really what they're doing, these types of productions, when you have an outer layer and an inner layer. So it's going to, that in halacha, let's say I would boil up the inner thing, I would pour milk, and the outer one is water and just a plain pot. So we say in halacha that the water on the outside of the double boiler, it becomes milk from the a container on the inside, even though it's a sealed metal container. Because we say that the blios, the tam, the flavor that's in the milk, is going into the pot and therefore going into the water, and therefore the whole big apparatus of your double boiler becomes milk. In the same way, therefore, in case you'd have an inner tube and an outer tube, and the outer tube has hot water and the inner tube has milk, so the outer tube would also become dairy.
So then when you're koshering pots for Pesach and stuff
yes.
like that, so once you put a milchik pot in there, in that boiling water...
It should be all become milchik.
That pot should become milchik.
Yes.
How do you put a fleshy pot in there?
That's a very good question. So that's why whenever you kosher for Pesach... whenever you kosher for Pesach, the first thing you tell people when they're bringing their pots is, make sure that your pot is eino ben yomo. Meaning to say that it's been 24 hours since it was last used. So the reason is because we say that after 24 hours, all the blios, everything that's been absorbed into the pot, its flavor becomes secondary, becomes pogum. It's not the same as it was, and a tam, which is pogum, a flavor which is already a little bit off, it's not as good as it was when it came in fresh, does not have the ability to impart its status onto anything else. So therefore, if the pot that you put into kosher is eino ben yomo, it won't influence the status of the water. That's why before Pesach, you should, if you're the rabbi of the synagogue, you should tell the people, make sure that any pot you bring to kosher, it has not been used within 24 hours. For Pesach, there's other ramifications as well. That's why you can't kosher with Hagola. We don't kosher after Chatzos on Erev Pesach. For that same reason. Meaning as follows, because on Pesach, all the rest of the year, we say that things are batel rov or batel b'shishim. On Pesach, we say that it's something becomes osur even on a little bit, even less than shishim. And you can only kasher for Pesach based on batel b'shishim before the Zman Isser, which is before Chatzos on Erev Pesach. But on Pesach itself, you can't. if you're kashering with Hagala.
So not on Pesach, if you're just kashering, let's say you have a giant pot that you use for fleishik, and you want to kasher like a utensil that's trave.
Right.
In that pot, you boil the water. What status does that fork come out with? Is that just a...
So if that pot was not used within 24 hours, and the fork was not used within 24 hours, then the fork is parf. Correct. And in fact, even if it was a fleishik pot, and you're koshering as long as everything is ena ben yomo, whatever comes out after you're koshered is parf. It's like you press the reset button. It's like it's brand new. Yes.
Is there still a status of dairy equipment? I remember there used to be a hechsher, OUDE or Starkey.
Okay, so some hechsherim put DE on their labels. The OU does not put DE. The Starkey does not put DE. The other hechsherim, I believe the Chav K and the Circle K, do put DE on their things.
And I saw an OUDE on something.
Yeah? OUDE?
K
does.
Should I call the OU?
The Circle K does.
Regular K also.
And the Chav K does. Regular K, okay. That which is under a separate rabbi.
Why do you not put a DE?
Because they feel that it's too confusing to the consumer to know what does DE mean. And they'll come to think, well, is it milchik or is it not milchik? So therefore, they generally put on, and we generally put on just a plain star D. I mean, call it dairy, not to get involved in the question. Part of our problem is, as a star K, is that star K on dairy products is reserved for things which are Chol Yisrael. And there's not too many things out there that would be Chol Yisrael DE. But on the star D products, which we do, which are not Chol Yisrael, anything that's under star K, well, let's put it this way, but try to be politically correct. Star K reserved the term star K for things which are Chol Yisrael. Things which are not Chol Yisrael are officially certified by the National Council of Young Israel as star D, which is run by the star K. So that's our politically correct way of saying that it's our politically correct way of saying that it is kosher. But it's not Chol Yisrael, would be with a star D symbol on it.
And then something Chol Yisrael would be a star K.
It would be star K D, correct.
When something says D E, could you assume that's Ena Ben Yomo?
You cannot assume that it's Ena Ben Yomo. That's part of the issue. That you don't know where.
But even if it's a suffix, Ena Ben Yomo is solid.
I mean, truth of the matter is, in many cases it is, but there's no way for me to. It's for sure a suffix, but.
Can you call the suffix Ena Ben Yomo? Is Ena Ben Yomo?
That's true.
Can you call the Star K office and ask, and they'll tell you
if it's a DE under somebody else's house?
No, under Star K.
If it's under Star K, likely if you get a hold of the rabbi, you can find out. But I mean, something that's Star D, that would be where the question is. But generally speaking, most places that want to have a DE don't come to the Star K for some reason or another. Just
if there's no milk ingredients, could you assume that it's only DE?
The only question is whether or not they have to declare that percentage of the ingredient or not.
So you can't assume that.
Not necessarily. A lot of the times things are marked as DE because they don't clean out the kalim between A and B. Let's say you're buying potato chips that say DE on it. So lots of times it's not actually dairy or OUD. If you look on the ingredients, there's no dairy listing in there, but because they don't necessarily clean out to anybody's satisfaction in between when they're making barbecue flavor and making onion flavor, so they'll make the barbecue as D or DE because they just ran onion flavor and the onion flavor has lactose in it or something like that. Those are just powders. Those are just powders. Well, lactose is milk sugar.
No, but because they didn't clean it.
Because they don't clean it, so they're saying that there's a possibility there's actual dairy parts in there, and they don't want you to get confused with that. So therefore, they say treat it as milchik. Yes.
We use soy milk and almond milk, and sometimes it says parv, and sometimes it says dairy.
Okay, so then it will depend on the manufacturer, and those are also usually the question is the equipment. Like if you look at, I think like the ones in the dairy case. Like Silk brand or something like that. Those say, I think, DE on them or dairy. And those are because they're run at dairies that process real milk. So when they're running afterwards the soy milk or the almond milk, they're running it on the same equipment.
So what does that mean?
It means that you shouldn't be using it together with your. You shouldn't be using it with your making a meat souffle. You shouldn't add it.
But you could have it after.
You can have it after. It's not real dairy. If you eat it, you can have meat afterwards.
If you eat meat, you can have that.
If you eat it, if you have it, then it, you should not mix it with meat. Now, as far as whether or not can you have it after meat, better not. Better to use a parvo.
And we don't say there that...
Stam keno menu b'nei yomah?
The guy is making it for themselves, and we're just buying it. It's a suffix, how much dairy it has, it might be bottled
barley. Well, no. No, it's like this. There is a concept to say that if the goy is making it for himself, then there's no problem of ein mevatlan iser lechatchila. That there is such a logic, and that's where you're coming from, that statement. But if the kelim are actually milchik a kelim, then it imparts a dairy status onto the product.
Even though we know it's batel beroi.
Well, if we know it's batel beroi, that's true. But I don't necessarily know that is the case over here. If they just ran, a dairy run where they're doing real cow juice, so then I don't know that the silk product that's run on the same equipment is also the same. Because they're running it through the same pasteurizers that they use for running the dairy. So it's not necessarily so that the amount of dairy absorbed into there is going to be bottle.
I don't know that it is. Same way around, why don't we just put D?
On some products they do put D. On some products they put DE because they have a question as to whether or not it's kashered properly and so on and so forth. Any other questions, or we'll just jump to another subject?
Have you been following this this cultured meat development thing?
I have not been following it, but I know there is this idea about cultured meat as far as growing it in labs and stuff like that. Right. Technically speaking, it would be par of.
Well,
yeah.
Fascinating.
Well, you know, right now I think the price per pound is like something like that. So, I'm not worried about it right now.
Cultured meat
is what they do is they have bacteria that will be able to grow actual meat proteins that'll taste like meat, look like meat, you know.
To have it. That's very expensive.
Yes.
Thank you to Starcade for making my grocery shopping much easier. The one thing that I do struggle with all the time is gum. I'm just curious, what's the ingredient in gum that makes it so hard to cosher?
Glycerin.
Glycerin?
Yeah. Now, the gum in itself, most of the bubble gum that you buy is synthetic materials. So there's not much question on it. It's like eating polyester. But, real gum would be the resin from the trees. And what they do to keep it soft is they heat it up and they add glycerin. Now, glycerin could be vegetable, could be animal. And so in order to get, it may be kosher, so you have to make sure that it's coming from a kosher source. Now, they do this at different stages of the manufacturing because we have companies that we do in China that are taking the actual gum rosin from the trees, the sap of trees, and they're mixing it with the glycerin. Then they're selling it to a gum manufacturer, and he does more or less the same thing. He heats it up, mixes it up with the glycerin, so that the glycerin has a little bit of a sweet taste to it, which they're not satisfied with the gum manufacturer because they'll add plenty more sugar and stuff like that. But it keeps it supple because otherwise it turns hard like a rock, which is what happens also sometimes, you see. If you leave it sit for a while, it gets hard like a rock.
Is that why you could get like those gums in Israel, the ones that have all the...
Well, again, any gum that you're finding with a hechsher, the reason is because somebody is overseen to say that the glycerin that's got in there and the processing equipment that's been used has been kosher. Because again, if you use these trays for making non-kosher gum, then you have a problem, in other words, because you put in non-kosher glycerin, so then you're going to have to kosher all those trays, which it's one thing to kosher, it's another thing to heat up the equipment. It's another thing in the first place to get it clean enough in order to kosher. And as you know, bubble gum is a little bit sticky. So it's not the easiest thing to actually clean in order to make it kosher in the first place. I just wanted to speak a couple minutes. Another thing that we deal with here in the Star K is dealing with appliances. And there's all kinds of questions as to what can be used and can't be used. Just the theory behind, let's say, the Sabbath mode on the ovens. First of all, Sabbath mode is a misnomer because it doesn't really help you all that much for Shabbos. It's more likely in Nogea, more apropos for usage on Yontif, as to whether or not if you can adjust or not adjust a temperature on an oven. That's really where it comes out. And the theory behind those which Rabbi Heinemann has said that you can use on Yontif are that because by putting the input, you're not showing anything. There's no display when it is in Sabbath mode. And it's not immediately taking place or any reaction or change. Therefore, it's not a direct action. And we find that a grumma, something that's a secondary reaction, is not treated the same as a direct action. Now, on Yontif, there's no isser of cooking, and there's no isser of burning. Those are permitted to do on Yontif when you're doing it for your bare necessities like food and heat. So the problem is there's an issa drabanan that you cannot strike a match on Yontif. You cannot initiate a flame.
So you say food or heat? Isn't it just food?
The Torah says food, right?
Oh,
okay. But the Gemara learns out to say that there's a din of mitoch shehutu litzarech hutanami shelo litzarech. Meaning to say that the things which are litzarech achol nefesh can even be done even if it's not for food. Now that, would the Rabbanan say, we limit that to things which are tzarech hayom, things that you need for the yontif. So something that you need for the yontif, like you don't want to be freezing on yontif, it's cold outside. So therefore, that also goes into tzarech hayom, so you can have find the variances in that. So that's the primary driver behind the reason why. What to say that you can use the Sabbath mode oven is the fact that the isser involved is not the fire. The isser involved is not the cooking, because those things are mutter to do on yontif. The isser involved is to initiate the flame or to initiate something. And that is an issa drabanan called molit, that you're creating a new situation. So by creating a flame, that is prohibited. If it's only an issa drabanan, we find that we're lenient on an issa drabanan if it's not a direct action, if it's coming through a grum, if it's coming through a secondary action. So where you create a situation where you're going to have a grumma on the issa drabanan, meaning to say that you're not directly initiating the flame, but you're going to be gorim, it's going to be a secondary action, then we can be lenient. So that's the driver behind the concept that if something has a Sabbath mode, that you'd be able to change the temperature or something like that, change its setting on Yontif. Now the basis for that goes back to the reason that most people are lenient to use old refrigerators, and that is because when you open the fridge, you're not turning on the compressor, but what you're going to do is you're going to cause the compressor to go on because you let warm air into the compartment of your refrigerator. So that is not a direct action, it's an indirect action. Now when the compressor goes on, it's not a melacha deraisa, because a motor running is not a melacha deraisa, but there is an issa drabanan of the fact that you are causing the motor to run. The issa drabanan is that when the electricity is causing the motor to turn, there are little sparks on the inside of a motor and so on and so forth, which you're not harnessing or using, but the creation of those little sparks would be an issa drabanan. And since you're only doing so in a secondary way, al yidei grumma, therefore that's the driver to say that you can be makel to open and close the refrigerator, at least on the old
on
ones.
Shabbos,
on Shabbos. So therefore, since we're makel, as the Paiskim say, since it's only an Isser Drabanan, and you're not doing the action directly, Therefore, you're allowed to open and close a refrigerator on Shabbos. Using that same logic, meaning to say that if it's a groma under a button, you could be lenient. That's why Rav Heinemann has said that on those situations with, let's say, a Sabbath mode oven, it's using the same logic to say if it's only a secondary action on a drabonon of Morlidesh that you're allowed to change the setting on Yontov. Yes?
So I actually just got a Sabbath mode oven. The quote in the manual after it explains the Sabbath mode, it says, if you happen to want to take out the light bulb, go to this page, and alternatively, if you want to keep on the light bulb, alternatively, you can just keep on the light bulb when you open and close the door.
Right, not all the Sabbath mode ovens are created equal. It's a big headache, because I think, what's your brand of GE? Okay, whatever it is, because some of them, they did it in the programming of the setting of the oven, and they didn't do anything to the lights. So you still have to, you didn't take care of that problem, so they have to give you that information in order to take care of it.
Usually on Shabbos, we'll shut it off before Shabbos, and then but we'll still open and close the door, which the light can still be a problem. But if you have the light on, it's staying on. So does anything electric happen when you open and close the door, or if the light's on, then...
Nothing that will make a halachic difference is taking place. Now, each oven is a different story as to what is taking place or what's not taking place. But the question is, if halachically it makes a difference, that you'd have to know your model.
So as long as the oven's completely off and the light is on, you can open and close it.
Correct. All right, Rabbi Holland's here to take you the rest of the way.
I'm forced. I'm ready. Sick. Came up lame.